a mind on its own, and I follow wherever it goes.
Does your body have a mind of its own? Do we neglect our bodies because we underestimate their intelligence? Amanda Smith with you, and this is The Body Sphere.
Where it goes, my body has a mind all its own.
Language itself teems with expressions that muddle up mind and body. My eyes pop with surprise and I prick up my ears. My shoulders slump with disappointment. I have butterflies in my stomach and my blood runs cold. I feel gripped by an idea or queasy at the very thought. I know things in my bones and I feel them in my water. A creepy tale makes my flesh crawl while a compliment makes me flush with pride.
That's Guy Claxton, the author of a book called Intelligence in the Flesh: Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. Okay, so you know the phrase, you need to listen to your body? Well, when you listen, what does it say to you?
Ouch! Lie down, for God's sake, and quickly.
I don't normally listen to my body. Yeah, I just do whatever I want to do and then suddenly realise, look, I shouldn't be able to do these things.
I don't think I'm very good at listening to what my body is telling me to do. I like to think that I work very quickly and I do a lot of things, and that maybe part of doing that is ignoring certain physicalities.
Well, I've just stepped off a long-haul flight and my body is telling me, go to bed now. My body nearly always says the same thing to me, which is cup of tea. And it's a sort of plaintive sound. Cup of tea! Bit like that.
Oh, that poor body. Well, now, in Intelligence in the Flesh, Guy Claxton gathers together the latest science and philosophy around what's known as embodied cognition. He offers up an argument about mind and body that's quite different to the traditional Western notion.
Well, I think for 2,000 years, broadly, and this is a broad generalisation, we've lived with an image of body and mind as being pretty separate and as mind being smarter and more valuable than body.
And of course, Descartes in the 17th century, he enshrines an extreme split. In one of his letters, he says, there's nothing in the mind that is of the body and vice versa. But perhaps you disagree, Guy, but hasn't that lost its currency?
I do think that this idea is still very prevalent. I mean, people jog and they have massages and, you know, taking care of the body is a very topical idea. But I would still ask the question, you know, which comes more naturally to you to say? Do you say, I have a body, or do you say, I am a body? And for most people, I have a body feels like the more natural way to say it. But once you've said that, you've separated I from the body. The I is somehow or other the owner or the driver or the manager or the supervisor of the body. So I think what embodied cognition is doing is really questioning that split and requiring us to move more in the direction of I am a body. For example, one interesting little study, if you encourage people in the direction of seeing mind and body as separate, you talk to them about dualism and then get them to prepare a little talk to someone else to try and convince them of the dualistic position. Then you send them off for lunch and ask them to come back again after lunch. People who've had that experience, the experience of, as it were, strengthening the idea that mind and body are separate, make less healthy choices when they go to the canteen of what their lunch is going to be than people who have had the contrary exercise of trying to argue for a much closer relationship between mind and body. So there are very practical, direct, physical consequences of putting mind and body back together.
Do we, though, equate the mind with the brain only. So, you know, it's still split from the rest of the body.
Mm. I mean, 100 years or so ago, plus or minus, people were struggling with this mind-body separation. And so they started to say, well, if mind is closely associated with body, which bit of the body, where can we put it? Where is the, so to speak, the natural home of the mind? And the obvious place, the first place to put it, was in the brain. And that's continued in neuroscience. In a way, neuroscience has contributed to the continuation of the mind-body split by associating mind pretty exclusively with the brain. And what science now, a whole lot of different kinds of experiments from cognitive science, from experimental psychology, from theoretical biology and so on, is telling us is that the intelligent organ, so to speak, has to include the body as well as the brain. I think for me, the summary is your body is your brain. The brain isn't just the lump of rather unimpressive looking porridge that sits between your two ears. The intelligent organ is all the information that is streaming around your body and up to your brain and down from your brain and from your heart to your liver and from your muscles to your skin. When we look at the true way in which intelligence functions, you have to look at ourselves. We have to look at ourselves as being this vast conglomerate of almost like a maelstrom of information currents, all of which need to talk to each other and somehow or other have to be resolved in real time into a concerted course of action. The brain is critical for that integration, so to speak, of information. But it's not the boss system. It's the chat room. It's the common room where different parts of the body come together to thrash out their concerns and their priorities. And obviously we need a place that does that. But if you try and sort of cut a line across your neck and say the intelligence is only is what goes on above that line and what goes on below the line is somehow or other merely instrumental or informative, then we do ourselves an injustice. We don't represent ourselves accurately. That's my reading of what the science is telling us.
Well, let's talk about some examples of intelligence in the flesh. Explain to me how the heart has its own little brain.
Well, the heart needs to talk to the other organs in the body because we're all part of one system. So, for example, if the heart stops listening to what's going on in the gut or what's going on in the muscles or what's going on in the lungs and sort of just functions in its own sweet way, it's not part of that kind of elastic connectivity of the body. So, for example, there are studies which show that a slightly irregular heartbeat is typical of a healthy heart.
Not a constant regular beat.
Not a constant regular beat. If your beat becomes too constant and too regular, that's predictive of heart disease, of an unhealthy heart, because it means the heart has, so to speak, stopped resonating, stopped seeing itself as a team player within the body as a whole, constantly able to kind of tweak and adjust its own rhythms to what's going on around it. So the idea that we can be looked at as an assembly of organs that can be sort of taken to bits and dealt with separately, the traditional image of Western medicine, if you like, we need to have another, you know, that gets you up to, gets you so far. But beyond a certain point, we need to look at ourselves systemically. And that involves saying the heart has its own central nervous system, its own chemical communication system, which talks not only to other bits of the body via the brain, but also talks directly, laterally, if you like. There's lots of crosstalk going on in the body, which is as important to this overall substrate, this overall underpinning of our intelligence, as the information which is streaming up to the brain and back down from the brain.
And the digestive system also, it has a mind of its own?
Indeed it does. I mean, there are famous books that are being, books or articles that are being written about the digestive system. There's one
which says, yes, the gut's the thing.
Yeah, the gut's the thing, or the digestive system. And then the subtitle is The Body's Second Brain. So everything that's going on in the gut is listening to what's going on elsewhere in the body and is responsive to it, and is also contributing to this, as it were, central conversation about what's the best thing to do next. So we have to look at all of these different aspects of ourselves in concert and in context, rather than as being separate from each other.
When you listen to your body, what does it say to you?
My body tells me when to stop eating, not to eat too much. It tells me when I'm tired. It tells me when I need energy. Because my tummy hurts or I feel uncomfortable. Now, I've learnt when it's starting to feel that way, so I stop.
It often says, listen to me more. The adrenaline rushing through it, or the nerves, or the energy, and that's what I'm trying to keep track of when I'm listening to my body. So the chemicals inside it, what that's doing to the way my thoughts are being processed. Yeah.
My body tells me when I'm going to get a migraine, because I get visual disturbances. I get physical things to do with my nose, my stomach. Sometimes my sense of smell gets extremely heightened, and so does my hearing. I can hear phones that are being called two houses down, and mentally I can get scrambled, and I know for certain 2 days later I'm going to have a migraine.
On air and online at RN, this is The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith, and a program about embodied cognition. That story about the physical signs of a migraine coming on is amazing, I think. But then again, a lot of what's going on inside you, the hundreds, thousands, millions of different impulses, well, you can't consciously comprehend them. Even so, Guy Claxton, the author of Intelligence in the Flesh, he says that for the body to be at its most intelligent, it has to be properly strung. He talks about developing interoceptive awareness. Now, what's that?
Interoceptive awareness is just a fancy scientist way of saying noticing, being conscious, being aware of what's going on in your body. And
even though
vary.
I can't see or know so much of it?
You can't see or know a huge amount of it, but the body sends its signals. For example, the gut sends a signal, or different bits of the body send a signal. If we are insensitive to those dashboard readings, you might say, from the body, it turns out that we behave less intelligently than if we are sensitive to those impulses. So the more conscious we can be of these promptings or messages or summaries of what's going on in the body, the more those influences can be taking part in the process that culminates in a decision or an action or a thought or a dream or a wondering or a whatever it might be. And therefore, the more well-founded in terms of our own deeper concerns those outcomes will be. So there are a number of studies which show that people who lack interoceptive awareness, who, for example, can't tell you how many times their heart beat in half a minute if they haven't got their finger on their pulse. Some people can, some people are good at it, some people are average at it, and some people are bad at it. Whether you can, as it were, keep an experiential track of your heartbeat predicts how good you are in certain kind of real life decision-making situations. It's as if more of the relevant information takes its place in that embodied decision-making process.
So are you saying that I should be paying attention to my beating heart? I should know my heart rate all the time?
I'm saying you don't have to be aware of it all the time, but that awareness should be available to you, so that if when you're trying to decide, I don't know, something you're trying on in a shop or something else, those gut feelings have value. They have relevance. They should be heeded in the decision-making process, because if you heed them, you will make better decisions. Not that you heed them uncritically, but that you allow them, as it were, to have a say in that decision-making process. You'll be more satisfied with the dress or the jeans when you got them home if you've listened to that intuitive voice than if you haven't. Now, in the old-fashioned way of celebrating only rationality, only the most logical, clear, explicit ways of thinking, intuition and gut feeling got a hard time, and so did emotion. They were seen as being untrustworthy aspects of the body. But what the science is telling us now is that you are less intelligent without those feelings than you are with them.
And I think that with people, for example, who are clinically depressed, now they've been found to have a kind of muted interoceptive awareness?
Yes, it's a very interesting case in point that when people are depressed, one of the things that makes depression so unfortunate and so distressing is you become indecisive. It's as if you can't decide what to do. You don't have a sense anymore of what's worth doing. So life feels a bit flat or a bit pointless. And that absence of the point or the feeling or the purpose or what's better than something else or what I want to do is connected with that awareness, that sensitivity to what's going on in your guts. People who are depressed have lower interoceptive awareness. And that's no coincidence. It's a good example of the research that I was just talking about. If that sense of your own inner process is muted, or if you're disconnected from it, perhaps because your feelings are distressed and you don't want to be distressed by your distress, we know we have ways of clamping down on our awareness of our emotions and our feelings. And in the short term, sometimes that might be helpful. But in the longer term, there is a cost to that. And it's a cost to our intelligent decision making and our intelligent action in the world.
Now, what does your whole argument mean for people with physical disabilities, Guy? I can't quite work out what the argument, how your argument might relate to that.
There isn't, in embodied cognition, there is no, unless there is damage to the circuitry whereby the body talks to itself and creates this sense of intelligent integration in itself. Unless that machinery is damaged, there are no implications for embodied cognition about the kind of body that you have, whether it's a large one or a small one or a brown one or a white one or a male one or a female one, or whether you've lost a leg or whether something else. The implication here is not that we need to have a particular kind of body, it's the way we relate to the body that we have. Because the argument is all about whatever kind of body you have, do you feel that that is you rather than is merely a kind of faulty housing that enables you to get from A to B?
When you listen to your body, what does it say to you?
If you look after me, I'll look after you.
I think it's really hard to listen to your body sometimes, but I try to respond to its messages as much as I can. You know, exercising often enough or eating healthily, but maybe the messages it sends don't always get through to me.
That I'm getting old. Things creak, ligaments don't work the way they used to, muscles don't respond the way they used to. I hurt in the morning. It's a horror.
If I have a bath at home and can feel all my muscles relaxing, and I feel like it's just somewhere that's quite isolated from your everyday life, so you're kind of, I feel like I'm listening to my body when I'm having a bath.
Now, does exercise, Guy, have any role in recalibrating our understanding of mind and body and its connection?
The research suggests that it does, but particular forms of exercise. So just kind of pumping iron or running around, or the kind of exercise that is associated with, you know, working your body in the gym or on the sports field, doesn't seem, I mean, the evidence is not hugely strong. I think the jury is still a little bit out on this. But the tendency in the evidence is that merely building strength or the body beautiful doesn't impact critically on this kind of embodied intelligence. What does help is our forms of exercise which build interoceptive awareness. So things like Tai Chi and yoga and biofeedback, which is just using an electronic device that gives you a visual signal of what your heartbeat is or what the activity in your gut is, and learning to regulate your heartbeat or your activity by controlling that visual signal. Those kinds of exercises that get us into our bodies, that get us interested in the internal workings, the internal feelings of our bodies, they do seem to be useful. But just merely getting stronger or fitter by itself can lead to a lowering of awareness of your internal process.
If you're a serious athlete, what you do get used to is being insensitive to some of the feelings in your body because you have to bear injuries and so forth.
Absolutely, that's a very good point. And I think there is a research field that is ripe for opening up here, which is what actually is the role? When is awareness of what's going on in your body helpful? When does it support your intelligence? And when? What are the times when we need to override it? It's not black and white, but I think the message of intelligence in the flesh is that we need to become more subtle or more able to modulate the extent to which we are sensitive to our own bodily processes. And there are times when it's good to be sensitive, and if we don't have that facility, then that acts to our detriment. And there are other times, as for example you're saying, you know, you've got to run the race but your muscles are feeling a bit sore, you get out and do it and you override those signals for a while. And sometimes it's smart to do that as well. And I think there's an awful lot in that field that we don't know yet, but give us another 10 or 20 years and I'll be able to answer that question better.
Well, what about other ways of using your body, making things, for example?
I'm very interested in the intelligence of making. A lot of my work has been in education, and it grieves me the way in which we disrespect or downplay what in my country is called vocational education. I think, you know, TAFE or something or other in Australia and in many other countries of the world. It's as if one symptom of this old-fashioned Cartesian view of the mind is if you're bright enough to do abstract things like learning Latin grammar or differential calculus, that's what you should do. If you're not bright enough, if your mind is not shiny enough and large enough, then you go off to woodwork and metalwork or cookery. And I think that really is grossly disrespectful to the intelligence of the body. There is research which looks carefully at the kinds of intelligence, the kinds of complex thinking that is required when you're fixing an old motorcycle engine or when you're working on a piece of furniture or installing a complex electrical circuit in an old building. When you're doing those things, it is not at all clear that what's going on in your mind as well as in your body is any less subtle or sophisticated than what a professor of philosophy does. And I think knowing that, we really should be making some adjustments to the kinds of values that are embodied, for example, in our educational systems. I think it should be just as honourable and seen as just as intelligent to opt for a life that revolves around a complex physical craft as it does to becoming a lawyer or a politician, someone who is clever with words but whose final output may not be as useful, as subtle, or as beautiful as someone who works with their hands could produce. So you can tell I feel quite strongly about this. I think this is one of the practical reappraisals of our culture which comes out of all the work on embodied cognition.
And Guy Claxton is the author of Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body More Than It Thinks. Details are on the Bodysphere website. When you listen to your body, what does it say to you?
My body usually tells me that I'm tired. That's its common answer to everything.
I think my body is laughing at me because I look in the mirror and I see myself at 25. I've just turned 60. So I think I look terrific, but my body keeps telling me, no, I think you're dreaming there.
Oh, well, it usually tells me to run around naked, so I have to ignore it.
My body has a mind of its own.
And when you listen to your body, what does it say? I'd love to hear your response to that. On the Bodysphere homepage, you can post a comment. Go on. abc.net.au/rn. Choose the Bodysphere from the drop-down program list. While you're there, you can subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. I'm Amanda Smith, and what's that body? What are you saying? Let's go to the beach. Sure.